coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start with politics. Former chair of the state GOP, Jennifer Nassour, and Globe political reporter Jim O'Sullivan join us. The mayor loses another bet at the Gaming Commission. What's his next move? And Beacon Hill moves to fix what the U.S. Supreme Court has undone. Then, which do you find more painful? Electric shocks or spending time alone with your thoughts? We'll ask you and tell you what Harvard researchers found.
We're all revved up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price on Pope Francis finally meeting with sex abuse victims and Burger King getting with the gay rights crowd. Then, Hiawatha Bray from the Boston Globe on his new book about cell phones and GPS devices, the many ways we navigate today. And we're going to ask you, how dependent are you on this new technology? Does anybody get directions to the gas station anymore? All that coming up on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Lovely out, isn't it?
It's lovely out, Jim.
It really is.
It's going to be lovely all week.
Yes, it is.
Hot.
So a new poll finds that nearly half of all Bay State voters would support a ballot question to legalize recreational marijuana. Could there actually be recreational marijuana in place before the medical marijuana dispensaries get off the ground? Here with us in Studio 3 to go over this and other political stories are Jennifer Nassour. Jennifer's the former chair of the Mass GOP. Hey, Jennifer.
Hello.
And Jim O'Sullivan writes about politics for the Boston Globe. Great to have you here, Jim.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you both for coming in. So I'm going to quote from one of your recent pieces, Jim O'Sullivan from the Boston Globe. You talked about the still somnolent race for the governor and the still flailing effort to implement casinos. And we're going to start with casinos because Jim is obsessed with the casino issue and whether people are flailing or not. And we've had two recent polls that said that people are getting more enthusiastic about casinos and less enthusiastic. The Herald's the outlier. We said at the Herald that they're less enthusiastic about polls. What do you think?
I think it's volatile given the amount of money that's going to be spent here between now and November. I think it's going to be a lot of money. I think you're going to hear a lot of opposition research from all sides, and you're going to hear a lot of what we heard back in 2009, 2010, 2011 about the benefits of casinos. And remember, it was framed back when they were trying to pass the bill at the State House. It was framed as jobs and revenue and property tax relief, and it's going to help the schools. So you're going to hear all these wonderful things that casinos will bring, and you're going to hear all about the social ills and the shady operators in the industry. So I think those numbers are going to move. I think those numbers are really subject to the news cycle.
You know, Jennifer, the GOP in the state has made almost a cottage industry about talking about corruption in government. Why isn't the GOP glommed on to stories like the great story was done in the Globe about the Everett Casino, where it turns out there are two felons who may or may not be involved in owning the land there? A document was signed saying there are no secret owners, but who knows if that's legitimate or not. Hasn't the GOP missed the boat on this one by sort of, other than criticizing Coakley for not wanting the casino question on the ballot, they basically are walking lockstep with Democrats on this, don't repeal the law.
Well, no. I think that now you have the ballot initiative for the casino ballot initiative that is going forward. And I think that group—
Charlie Baker's voting against it.
Well, the group that's pushing it is now going to get what they want. And once it goes through, once it passes, I think that that will open up a hole. And this goes to their argument. This is why we should have it out to the voters to see whether we should have casinos or not, because you have already so many shady people that are coming out of the woodwork that are being found. And so and a mayor of a city who is, you know, taking donations from them and saying, oh, well, I won't take any more donations.
We should be clear, the follow-up Globe story was the mayor of Revere who has criticized the shady characters, the felons in Everett, who may or at least had some interest in the land. And it turns out he's taken financial contributions from both of the so-called shady characters. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, exactly. Which, again, goes to the repeal the casino ballot initiative to their argument.
You know, there is a great quote in this story about the so-called shady characters. The State Gambling Commission, I think we should call them the Gambling Commission instead of the Gaming Commission, by the way. It just kind of cleans it up when we call them the Gaming Commission. Anyway, the Gambling Commission released transcripts of conversations between one of these felons and his incarcerated friend, in which the felon suggested he'd agreed to take his name off official land records on the parcel in Everett. And there's a quote here. I'll take my name off. I have no problem. These casinos, they see my name in there. They ain't going to like it, he says. And the other guy replies, you need to double blind it. You need to double blind it. You need to triple blind it, actually. I mean, it's unbelievable that this is sort of, I guess this is why you called it flailing.
Well, that was why, and I go back to the original casino debate. Governor Patrick was so reluctant to move ahead with this bill. He proposed it, but it was not something you could tell his heart was never really in it. He liked the idea of the revenue, but the governor and people around him were very concerned about introducing this quote-unquote element into the state. And
well, first of all, the original debate, he lost. He was crushed when DeMasi was the speaker, and DeMasi got his people to overwhelmingly reject this thing. And then 3 years later, 64 of them flipped their votes.
Speaker DeLeo came in, and the dynamics changed in the House, and both DeLeo and Patrick were in favor of expanded gambling. They bickered extensively over the details of it. And the other thing is that it, as Patrick said, and this is a verbatim quote, if not a paraphrase, he said it sucks up all the oxygen because it fascinates people. It fascinates the press. It fascinates readers. It fascinates voters. It's just a completely foreign industry that we've introduced into Massachusetts. And as you can see, we're really struggling to implement it on a number of levels.
Can I ask you to irresponsibly speculate, Jim
sure.
O'Sullivan from the Boston Globe? If it turns out Deval Patrick and the members of the legislature had an opportunity to do this all over again in 2014, would they? Based on what they know now, through whatever day this is, July 7th of 2014, economy's better, unemployment rate down, revenues better, all these stories that are coming out about at least iffy issues, problems with the gaming commission. Would they do it again?
I think the legislature would. I'm less certain about the governor. I'm not sure where the governor would go because I think what he saw was a deal where can we, as he said, lift up the whole state and you cut a little bit of a devil's bargain. You get all this revenue in that can do all these great things, and he's an expansive government guy, and he thinks it's wonderful we can improve the schools, we can improve the roads, and we're willing to take a little bit of the gutter stuff that comes along with it. So I that would be an interesting thing to ask him.
Now, Jennifer Nassar, you've been with us a few times talking politics. I want to give you a little insight into my co-host here, Jim Browdy. We had the day off, was it Wednesday, I believe, correct?
Yes, Marjorie.
And how did you spend that day off, which I think is a little demented, if you ask me?
Well, I must admit, at Bunker Hill Community College. I attended a gaming commission hearing. This was on, I look at the look on Jennifer Nassar's face.
Wouldn't you do that? It was like 90 degrees.
It was.
Hot and
first thing I would do.
First thing I'd do.
And by the way, I took away two things from it, other than the fact that there's no visitor parking at Bunker Hill Community College, which is probably the most important thing, is one, I am convinced that Marty, we asked Marty Walsh when he was here a week or so ago, are you ultimately going to support repeal? And he said, well, let's see what happens with this delay thing. He was asking the casino commission, the gaming commission, to delay until after the November vote, awarding any other casino to the Boston area, to Everett or Revere or that sort of thing. They rejected it 4-0. They basically ridiculed his lawyer, Gino Flaherty. They did it semi-politely, but they were ridiculing him. I can see him becoming a high-profile leader of the effort to repeal this thing. Can you?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, if there's one in Boston, right, so he's the biggest voice that we have in the city. And so the biggest known voice and that is could make a mess out of this. And so his point is valid. And as someone who lives in the city, there is already so much traffic. We're going to add more traffic. Poor Charlestown is already inundated with so much traffic. It's a pain in the neck to get over there and get anywhere else. So this is a big issue at stake for him. That's number one. I think when you look at everything going on around the state, they have to halt everything that they're doing. And of course, the casino people are saying, wait a second, we've already spent millions and millions of dollars trying to get this deal done. But who cares? They don't live here. We as residents live here, and the voters should have a say over where this goes.
Yeah, now, but the argument, mayor in all is fairness, let me interrupt you. In all fairness, the four members of the commission who voted against the position of the city said, well, wait a second. If we award casinos licenses in the southeastern part of the state, or at least in the eastern district, which is arguably the most important one, or at least the highest revenue producing one, more information will be available to the voters rather than speculation. Isn't that better for the voters to know more rather than know less? And while the lawyer for the city disagreed with that, that's what carried the day, meaning you don't agree with that.
I just think that it's a really convoluted way of telling him, no, we're not doing what you want to do. We're going ahead and continuously doing what we want to do.
What's your sense on Walsh, Jim O'Sullivan? I mean, I think he's like working himself into a fevered pitch over this whole thing. Every single thing he's asked them to do, they've said no to, whether his demands have been reasonable or unreasonable. It seems he's building to opposition. No?
It's a really tough political calculus for him when you consider just from his base is unions. He worked hard to pass that bill. He worked hard before.
And he voted for it, we should say.
And he voted
for it. Right.
And he worked hard before that to push slots and unions in favor of slots before they're in favor, before they even knew casinos could be possible. He was in the room. It's one of the things that brought him in from the cold with Speaker DeLeo was DeLeo was trying to beat Patrick at the 11th hour in 2010, just before the legislative session expired. And he turned to Walsh because he thought Walsh would be a key ally and a key advisor with the unions. So the mayor has gone from, in a different lifetime, a huge supporter and key advocate of casinos to now. You look at the coalition that got him elected last November, he and his people very skillfully positioned him as the progressive choice against John Conley and the progressives in Boston. I mean, you go to Jamaica Plain and poll casinos, it's not going to do very well. So he's got to really decide between the people who got him into the final election, which were the unions and his base in South Boston and Dorchester, and the people who pushed him over the top, which are the progressives. And they're sort of at odds on this issue.
It's not just progressives. I mean, he talks – when he's been here, he said very much like what you said. You know, I was a legislator. I had one responsible, and now I'm responsible to people. Boston, forget JP for a moment, even though I think your point is well taken. The vote was taken in East Boston. Right. They rejected it overwhelmingly. Right. I'm assuming Charlestown, the next neighboring community, feels the same way. So if the two communities who abut don't like this thing, you get the worst of a casino, meaning the fallout, without the best, meaning it's not situated in Boston, you don't get all the benefits. I'm surprised he hasn't been come out against this thing already, despite
and started
the
making
issue.
Ads. Hi, I'm Marty Walsh, and I oppose casinos.
Well, maybe. I mean, that'd be a pretty powerful voice.
If you make that choice to go that hard on it.
But at the same time, we've pointed out a million times over here that the big money from Marty Walsh versus John Conley came in from unions.
Right.
So that's a factor he's got to... How much do you want to tick them off when they gave you all that financial support?
But at the end of the day, the people that he needs their vote the next time are all those people with where this casino would be, that would affect them. Because Charlestown overwhelmingly went for Connolly. He's got to win their votes this time.
That's a great
and
point,
so he's
too.
Got to win them back. And you, those are the people you need to appease now.
Now, well, speaking of Belk, yeah, I know
on?
What you want to move to.
Well, we talk about casinos so much, it drives me crazy because Jim is obsessed with this. But there are some other great ballot questions, as you point out, that have been kind of overshadowed by the whole casino thing.
Not me, you mean Jim O'Sullivan points out.
That's right, Jim O'Sullivan over here from the Boston Globe. The bottle bill, you know, that we'd be water and other non-carbonated drinks would fall under the same classification as nickel a can system. Now, this has not done very well in the legislature, but you know, people are getting a little revved up now about these climate change things, I think more than they have been in the past.
They call the bottle bill the Full Employment Act for the legislative advocacy community on Beacon Hill, because if you go onto Secretary of State Galvin's website and look who's registered to lobby on the bottle bill, it really is unbelievable. The constituency out there, and it's sort of a hidden constituency, but it's all these soft drink makers and water bottle makers who deep-pocketed folks.
Constituency against the bottle bill.
Against expansion of the bottle bill.
Okay.
Yes. So that's a good one. There's another, you know, paid sick leave is another good one.
Brought to you by the same people who collected signatures for the minimum wage, which has been dropped because
Raise
of the legislature.
Massachusetts, the repeal of the indexing to inflation of the gas tax, which I believe Baker's, I think, attended a rally in favor of this. It's one of those ones where the legislature doesn't have to vote again to raise taxes because inflation is going to go up in perpetuity.
Now, you know what? Even if you want a gas tax, the fact that they're trying to weasel their way out of this by not having to vote against it would make me say, vote against it. Go ahead,
what
Jennifer Nasur.
Spineless jellyfish do we elect to office? Seriously, you don't even have the nerve to say, okay, well, every year we'll take this under consideration and we'll think about it and we'll see what our constituents want. You say, here, in the middle of the night, we're going to pass this. We're going to stick it in there and no one's going to see what we're doing. Spineless.
Well, wait a second. Speaking of spineless.
And so spineless is the nice word.
Your position and apparently Marjorie's.
Don't they do this with their salaries, or am I mistaken about that? Haven't they raised their salaries in a way that
well,
they don't
the Constitution
have to vote
was,
about
wasn't
it
the Constitution?
Anymore?
But can we stay there?
I mean,
let's just stay on this.
That's bad enough.
Excuse me. There are more than $1 billion in corporate tax breaks. Mm-hmm. When passed, Jennifer Nasur and the Republicans who support this repeal of the indexing, the gas tax, Do they ever look at that to see whether or not the jobs were created that the billions of dollars of tax breaks produce? No. So those don't have to be looked at. But if we want to raise the gas tax 2% based on inflation, that we do have to look at.
Exactly. Not make
a right, Jim Browdy.
Okay, I've heard that. Okay, one last question. Get to the question.
Any of the ballot questions we're missing?
No, but you want to talk about a ballot question that may exist in 2016.
I want to talk about the marijuana
question. Talk about obsession.
Well, talk about another flailing thing. This whole thing with the medical marijuana is flailing all over the place. It was almost 2 years ago the voters voted for it. We still don't know whether we're going to have any of these places or where they're going to be or what's going to happen with that.
I interviewed the head of it the other night. She was actually pretty impressive, Karen Van Unen, and who's taking over. And she says, for whatever it's worth, even though they promised they'd first round will be open this summer, first round will be in November, second round in February. I don't know if it's going to happen, but she seemed to be on top of
it. That drives me nuts about it. I know everybody thinks that this is a backdoor or a front door way, whatever it is, to get in to legalize marijuana completely. But there are people that do claim this is giving them relief from suffering, and it's terrible that we're making these people wait. But in any case, we have this a new poll that says that 48% of people in Massachusetts would be for the full legalization and 47 against. Now, I thought that was pretty impressive. You thought it wasn't that impressive. What do you think, Jennifer Nasir, in terms of the fact that the theory being that in the 70s we thought this, forget about it, now we've moved to it's almost half of the people in Massachusetts seem ready for full-blown legalization.
Well, I think if you look at the statistics, though, so it was, 605 people that were surveyed.
It's small.
It was a small group.
It's not small. It's not small.
Well, it's pretty small. But if you look at it, it breaks down exactly along demographic lines. Yeah. So if you're talking to a parent, if you're talking to someone in their 60s, if you're talking to a Republican, I mean, and some of the more conservative moderates and independents out there, I mean, it really breaks down along. So if you're asking the recent college grad, of course you're going to get a positive response, as opposed to the parent who has a tween who you're thinking, well, this might be a gateway drug. So
what kind of hypocrites are the parents, though? Every one of whom was smoking marijuana
absolutely.
When they were younger. I mean,
you know,
please.
I don't disagree with you, but here is, I think, a more kind of, you know, an argument that you can I talk about with my friends is that when you're a kid and you drink before you're 21, it's like, oh my God, I drank. Isn't that so scary? And then you turn 21, you're like, this is so not fun anymore. And then same thing with pot. If you smoke pot and it's illegal, it's that fear and it's fun because you're scared. But then what happens when you make it legal? Then what's the next thing? So then you say, okay, well now in order to, you know, do something a little bit more scary, I've got to go do coke or heroin or meth. I mean,
really,
I don't know if we
that?
Want to get that. I do, because I think it's always
like
the excitement of doing something that no one thinks
that
you're
But it's still
going
to be illegal if you're under 21. It's going to be exactly like liquor
so
is
drinking.
Today. Right, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So marijuana will, even if it's legalized statewide, it will still be illegal for kids. So what I'm saying is marijuana would be in the same boat as drinking.
Yeah.
What do you think, Jim O'Sullivan? Am I going to be able to smoke dope in the old folks' home? You know, I think it's going to pass if they put this on the ballot in 2016.
Well, the way the demographics and the trends are going are I think, positive for the people who want to get it on the ballot, because if you're statistically tied now, there's going to be a lot more money spent on the pro marijuana side, I think, than on the negative side. So those opinions, again, are subject and vulnerable to change. And it does break down along demographics, and they're making more younger voters, and they're not making more older voters.
So my theory is on this, that law enforcement, which comes out in force against us all the time.
As they did on the first two marijuana questions.
Exactly. They were, you know, whether
decriminalization
it was
Martha
Coakley, whether it was the state police, no matter who, with district attorneys, they were all opposed to it. And then voters 2-1 said, well, no, forget that, district attorneys, we want to do this. And my thing is, the same is going to happen.
This is another bridge, though. This is legalizing recreational use, and you are going to hear a lot about the gateway drug. You know, if you try that, you're going to try something else. I think that's probably the most salient argument that we've heard against it. And in a state that has, you know, a still growing opiate crisis, that could prove pretty powerful.
Well, let me tell you why I think you're wrong, Jim O'Sullivan. I'm going to quote you from a couple of minutes ago. The legislature would still vote for casinos in your estimation.
I don't think I stated an opinion.
Well, you did actually do that. And the reason I think you're right is because when you are a tax-phobic body, like most legislatures are, you pray for things like casinos and the lottery. And even though it would be a tax, you see how much they raised in the first couple of months in Colorado,
huge,
where we're along with Washington State, they legalized it. This is ready, beyond the fact that it's safer than buying. hanging on the street. Why are you smirking like that? I'm talking about Jim O'Sullivan, by the way. He's smirking at me. But putting that aside, it's huge tax revenue in a state that always wants more tax revenue. So my sense is that's going to outweigh, at the end of the day, the whole issue of the danger, the slippery slope, and all that.
Massachusetts, too. Casinos, weed, and 4 a.m. closing times.
Right,
I mean,
awesome.
That's talk about an economic growth factor, bringing college students
that's
to the state
right.
alone.
The Puritans were, they were a long time ago. Let's move on. We're talking with Jennifer Nasura and Jim O'Sullivan from the Boston Globe about the issues of the day. Stephanie Ebert wrote a great piece in the Boston Globe. One of the big themes of, the Martha Coakley loss to Scott Brown was that, she was kind of a stiff and she was chill. And she was a lousy campaigner. So she's supposedly becoming more warm and friendly this time around. And Charlie Baker got the same rap when he lost to Deval Patrick, that he was angry and bitter and all this kind of stuff. She has this piece, I found this incredible, that talks about how poor Charlie Baker, gets sent off to this body coaching person to tell him to rein in his gestures because he was gesticulating so wildly it made him look like he was ticked off. And meanwhile, Martha Coakley, who was supposed to become more fuzzy and warm this time around, tells these really touching and sad stories about her brother, who actually suffered from mental illness and took his own life. And she still does it in a very clipped, competent tone. So my question to you guys is Charlie Baker the new Charlie Baker? Is Martha Coakley the new Martha Coakley or not?
Okay, so I'm going to start on Baker and say that...
You're supporting Baker, I assume, yes?
Yes.
Okay, well, I just want to know, okay.
Former chair of the Massachusetts GOP, I should have said
before.
Well, it's
a primary. I just want to know if she was staying neutral. Go ahead.
No, I'm definitely a Baker supporter. So I would say that Charlie's a big guy, right? And so sometimes when you see him talk, and being Italian, I could say this, I use my hands a lot. But I'm a little person, so using my hands...
Charlie's 6'5", for people who don't
right,
know.
And so when Charlie uses
six.
His...
Well,
his
six?
Arms.
Wow.
It's a lot of person moving
like a
around.
Bird, like a bird.
And so I think it's great. And I don't think that you're changing someone by changing their gestures and their mannerisms. I think it's just a difference between, being scary and having arms all over the place or just being a little bit more contained in your personal
okay,
life.
Okay, nice try, Jennifer. Let me tell you right now, if you see the full page ad a week ago Friday in the new Capitol section of the Globe where Charlie is the Dorchester Day Parade he's marching?
Sun Parade.
Whatever it was. Charlie is in blue jeans and a t-shirt.
Yes,
tell me
I
you
saw that.
Ever saw Charlie in blue jeans and a t-shirt
well, maybe hang around
three
at
and a
home
half years
he,
ago.
He
yeah, at home,
was?
But not on the campaign trail.
Right. Well, I mean, look, you can look a little different. Coakley looks different. She's not wearing the same ugly shoes she wore last time. She looks a little bit more relaxed.
Wait, she had ugly shoes last time?
Oh, her shoes. There was a picture of her, and it must have been in the Herald, too. Just a picture of the shoes she was wearing, and they were awful. I mean,
so she's got the strappy, sexy ones now.
Right. So now she has nice shoes, and then she...
That's what really cost her in 2010,
other,
by the way.
It is.
The shoes. Very 2010.
Yeah.
And then, wearing a denim, looks like a little denim dress with a belt, and so she definitely has changed her appearance. But I think the difference is being warm and fuzzy, trying to control your body language is one thing. Trying to change who you are internally is a whole other thing. So I think it's very tough to try to become warm and fuzzy and to tell those, very sad story. And I'm sure, it's nice to hear her bring some personal stories out to the forefront. But I don't know about warm and fuzzy. And I'm sure right after the election, she can go right back to being who she is. And that's not a knock on her. Everyone is who they are. Charlie, on the other hand, when you're with him, like his whole big frame, you see him, he comes down and he gives you a hug and he's just more of a he is the one.
Yeah, but he's
fuzzy
not going to hug. That's sort of what's. I find Charlie personally when he's
hugs,
in the studio,
he hugs you, Jim.
Incredibly warm. And but
he
that's
does.
Sort of like what people said about Al Gore after he lost. Al Gore, if you know him, he's one of the funniest, loosest guys. It's how you interact publicly with thousands of people, not how you interact one on one. Because he's not going to go meet 3 million voters.
I don't know if there's a contest between Coakley and Baker that Coakley is.
Well, I agree. Neither
win
of them. I agree. Neither of them are Deval Patrick in terms of the ability to connect and all that. Interestingly, by the way, as a history lesson, do you know where the story emerged about the angry Charlie Baker 4 years ago? We did a gubernatorial debate at our old radio station, and during the debate, I think they were talking about education, Charlie banged the table in our studio. The next day, Globe did a front page story. Is he too angry to be governor? Will you explain to me, Jim O'Sullivan, your line about it's still somnolent, this race? Even though I know they both lost in prior elections, obviously the Scott Brown race with Martha Coakley and the Deval Patrick race with Charlie Baker, I think they're really strong candidates. I think on the Democratic side, there are strong candidates. Mark Fisher has disappeared. We'll talk about that in a minute, the Tea Party opponent of Charlie Baker. At least a couple of the independent candidates have a pulse. Evan Falchuk's going to be in studio with us tomorrow. Why? I think your analysis is right. Why has this been so sleepy so far?
I think there are a number of things. We've become sort of conditioned over the last several election cycles to having this sort of win over the people charismatic candidate, whether it was Elizabeth Warren in 12 or Scott Brown in 10 or Deval Patrick in 06. We've really been spoiled because we've had top-notch candidates here. And I think if you look at these folks, a lot of them, I think they would be judged in the eyes of the electorate as more proficient as a servant in office rather than a candidate.
Running for,
These are people who are not necessarily or have not proven themselves great campaigners. That's one of the great things about the Baker, Coakley, and Steph story was terrific. There's this sort of powerful redemption narrative for both of these folks from 2010 when they ran these lousy campaigns. And it's not genius-level political strategy to figure out what they have to do. They have to make themselves come across as more personally appealing in both cases. And that's what that story is really about.
You know, somebody who I thought actually did have a pulse, I interviewed on television Mark Fisher nonstop during this legal challenge. You know, he said that the ballots were cooked at the Republican convention. He actually had 15%. He even suggested to me that a crime may have been committed by the party, all that sort of thing. What, I know you're supporting Baker. What happened to Mark Fisher? He was everywhere until he was granted ballot status. I literally have seen nothing out of this guy. No emails, no nothing since. What happened to him?
Okay, so I'm going to say that the day of the convention, I said they should let him on. He should be. I've said it here. I've said it 1,000 times. If they let him on, there wouldn't have been a story. And guess what happened? As soon as he got on, where'd he go? He went back home. That's it. Story's over. There is no primary.
Well, you have a bias.
There's a primary on paper. It doesn't matter. I mean, look, at the end, he's going to get, 11% on primary day. And that's it. He's going to go away.
What's your analysis? Would there be debate?
Oh, yeah. Excuse me. I'm doing the final debate. Thank you, on television the Friday before the primary.
Baker.
Yes,
I did not realize
and I think
that.
This
Jim,
was, thank you, Jim, sorry. For smiling at that. What's your analysis? What did happen to Mark Fisher? By the way, I think he's got a pulse. I think he's got a decent personality. He's not one who's running away from his conservative credentials, which I think, by the way, is good for Charlie Baker, as Bill Weld said in a story. It's great because it allows Charlie to look even more moderate. What happened to Fisher?
If I were Baker, I would want more debates with
exactly.
Mark Fisher.
Exactly. And there may be. I don't know how many
there are. In the eyes of the Massachusetts, the general electorate, as more moderate. I think if you could go back and ask the Baker people and the party people if they wish they had done the convention differently, of course they would, because they made the process the story, and they made it look like this insider's game, which to some extent it was. Fisher gives a great speech. He had this great line at the convention about how big tents are for circuses, and we've got enough clowns with the Democrats in Massachusetts. We don't need any more. And he's very adherent to those principles. He speaks to a certain segment of the Republican Party and libertarians, and he has a pretty compelling message for a lot of people. But the Baker people want to put that on display and offset Charlie against that. Mm-hmm.
Just one thing before we move off this topic. I know that Charlie Baker, he's supposed to be less angry this time around, not flapping around like a bird so much with the big arms and all that kind of thing. But his 2010 campaign mantra was "had enough," as Stephanie wrote in the story. I really like that because, in his case, he was referring to Deval Patrick, and Deval Patrick is popular, but there have been a lot of missteps, a lot of mismanagement from DCF to the marijuana, the medicinal marijuana rollout, et cetera. So anyway, he's gone from "had enough" in 2010 to "let's be great Massachusetts," which is supposed to be, upbeat and positive and all that kind of stuff. I thought "had enough" was a million times better. What do you think, Jennifer Nasser, former head of the Mass GOP?
I liked "had enough," and I thought that you could have so much fun with it, and it was something that was really good to get out there and get people excited.
Yeah.
And I think being great again is wonderful, and it's good to hear. But I don't know if you're trying to attract 18 to 29-year-olds if they know about making Massachusetts great again. I don't even know if they're thinking of staying in Massachusetts, right? And so I think it's more of the getting people excited and getting them to be part of a campaign and to feel the momentum. But I think what happened the last time was that Charlie appeared to be so mad when he was saying, "Have you had enough?" It was like, "We're pissed and we're going to go tear down the castle doors," instead of, let's "we had enough and now we're going to make changes."
Oh, come on, Marjorie. Great is overrated, don't you think? I mean, I mean, really.
Being just a little mealy mouth. Let's be great, Massachusetts. Okay, all right. I didn't know we weren't great already kind of thing. Or maybe we could be. I don't know. It's just not.
You know, speaking of being great, there has been no person who has advocated, and I mean this sincerely, more powerfully for a vibrant Republican Party in the state than me. Because I, and you know this, Jennifer DeSore, my position,
no,
it's true.
You're
I do it all the time. My attitude is the only reason, no, I'm serious. I believe the reason we had three felonious speakers is because there's no Republican Party.
It was a segue, Jim.
No, I'm
speaking of being great.
Well,
interesting.
Forget
okay.
That. I didn't
the
mean
great
me.
Jim Browdy
okay,
will now continue.
Okay,
go
sorry
ahead.
Sorry I said that. But here's my, but so the stronger, the better. The more credible candidates, the better. State Senator Bob Hedlund was here last week or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was. I can't remember. I asked him to name all of the constitutional office candidates. Jennifer's getting nervous now, who are running on the Republican side, because I think the better they do, in fact, maybe winning a race or two, in addition to obviously Baker and Polito, who are in a real serious race, obviously, with whoever the Democrat is. Can you name can you name all of the Republicans running for statewide office, Jennifer DeSore?
I think I pretty much.
Go ahead, do it.
Could.
Go ahead.
So you have
who's running for Attorney General? That's the one
that
Hedlund couldn't remember.
To.
Okay.
I don't know either.
Can you name him, Jim O'Sullivan?
I don't know.
Thank you, Miller.
Okay. I knew it was.
Who's running for Secretary of State?
David Darkangelo.
Very good. How about State Treasurer?
It is Heffernan.
And State Auditor?
Patricia St. Auburn.
Okay, that's not.
Wow.
How about U.S. Senate?
Wow, we are impressed.
U.S. Senate. It's not that impressive. Four
it's
or three out of four.
Impressive.
How about U.S. Senate? You know,
Brian Herr.
Very good. Now, I'm serious. When is this ever going to change? When is there going to? And obviously, it would change a lot if Baker ended up winning the primary and got elected governor. But he'd be sitting atop. He likes to make analogies to his mentor, Bill Weld. Bill Weld had a Senate that could sustain his vetoes. Even if this goes wildly well for the Republicans, it's still going to be 95% Democrats on Beacon Hill. When is this? I mean, you ran the party. When is this ever going
to
change?
Okay, so it has to start changing little by little. I know you hate when I tell you this.
No, it's fine.
It has to start changing little by little. It has to start changing the legislature. The state reps have to move up and run for state senate. We do already have one of the state reps, Ryan Fatman, who is running for state senate. That's awesome. And I think Ryan has a really fabulous opportunity of winning that seat. You have a lot of people who are running for state reps and for state senate. There's a possibility if Baker wins, he's going to pull everyone else over. And if you haven't met Heffernan, you should meet him because he's a really good, smart guy. And the fact that the treasurer position is open, I think that's an amazing opportunity for
Grossman's
us right there.
Running for governor. Mm-hmm.
But Jim O'Sullivan from the Boston Globe, part of the problem is, for the Republicans in Massachusetts, I think, has got to be that they get sucked in by these national Republican kind of things. So when you have some, even if they have nothing to do with Massachusetts, if you have someone make some crazy statement that's a Republican, they get sucked into this vortex.
Right. And that's why I think the former chair is right. It's so important for the party to build from the ground up. So you give people who run for selectman, run for state rep, run for state senate, and have their own record to run on and say, hey, look, I worked with you on local issues. I worked with you on property tax relief. I worked with you on schools. You can't tie me to Jim Inhofe in Oklahoma or the National Tea Party. I'm a Massachusetts person, and I have a record here in Massachusetts to run on. And that's how the party does the same thing all the time. They have this sort of messianic complex where they look for this, you know, knight in shining armor to come in and run for governor or senate or one of the top level offices, and they don't do the sort of, to use a Weldism, the blocking and tackling at the local level. And that's really how, if you're going to have a sustainable, long term, viable party, that's the way to do it.
I just make one comment too? Both Brian Herr, who's running for Senate, and David Darkangelo have been selectmen and city councilors. And so
that is hugely important,
no,
by the way.
They have their pulse on their communities.
Yeah.
They've had to do that local outreach, right? And so I think you have to look at it as, even if you're going from that level office to running for statewide office, that's an amazing experience that they've had to actually have run for office before, been elected, and have to have dealt with those local issues.
Before you leave, Jennifer DeSore, I'm going to be very generous, and I'm going to give you an idea that I borrowed from somebody else. The slogan, I think, for the Republicans to pull this thing together this round, I'm just doing this as, you know, an even-handed person, casinos, marijuana, and 4 a.m. closing. What do you think of that, Jim O'Sullivan?
I think that's a winner. That's how you get the youth vote, for sure.
Exactly. Thank you.
Okay.
I mean, you should be a political consultant, Jim. That is a brilliant idea. I love that.
Jennifer Nasir is the former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and Jim O'Sullivan writes about politics for the Boston Globe. Thank you both for
coming in.
It was lots of fun, and I think you did extraordinarily well in that quiz. Jim thought you were going to get them all wrong.
I did, actually.
He really did.
Really?
Did quite That's
well.
Right.
Man.
Okay.
It doesn't say a lot.
How dark is your interior life? Would you prefer an electric shock to being
left alone
with your own thoughts? Well, a new poll says you would. We're taking your calls on this next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, Adam Riley reports on an innovative new push to get kids away from their screens and into the great outdoors. Tomorrow, only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
If there's a vehicle at home you no longer need, why not turn it into something everyone counts on? More great stuff on WGBH through our vehicle donation program. Visit wgbh.org/cardonation.
Support for our programs comes from you and the X1 DVR from Xfinity, a multi-room DVR. You can record up to 4 shows at once while watching live TV and take your DVR recordings to go. It's all part of the X1 Entertainment Operating System. More at 1-800-XFINITY. And It's Your Move, Inc., a move management company specializing in the planning, orchestrating, and execution of moves for senior citizens downsizing from large homes to smaller spaces. More info available at itsyourmoveinc.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. According to a new study published in Science as a journal, people, and especially men, hate being alone with their own thoughts. We hate it so much. Listen to this. We'd rather be in physical pain than stuck in our own internal world. Researchers found about a quarter of women, two-thirds of men, chose, and I mean this sincerely, electric shocks over their own company. Now, imagine if electric shock technology existed, Marjorie, in the 1850s. Do you think Thoreau would have chosen electric shocks over wandering in the wilderness? Here's what he had to say about being left to his own thoughts. This is great. Quote, "You think that I am impoverishing myself, withdrawing from men, but in my solitude I have woven for myself a silken web or chrysalis, and nymph-like shall ere long burst forth a more perfect creature fitted for a higher society." Is that beautiful?
Wow.
That's me. So where are you on this? Would you prefer to be shocked, than electric shock to be specific, than to be left with your own thoughts and company? If so, why? Or are you in the minority, like Thoreau, preferring to weave that silken chrysalis when left to your own musings? Our number is 617-877-301-8970. When I saw the Globe story last week, Marjorie, and I emailed you and Chelsea.
No, 617.
Our, what did I say? Did I say 617?
It's 877.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
877-301-8970.
When I saw this headline, "People prefer electric shocks to time alone with thought," I thought it was like a funny column in the Globe. It is a study in this journal Science. It was done by University of Virginia and Harvard. They have these people in a lab. By themselves.
Yeah.
They asked them to rate the experience. They virtually all rated it 5
Horrible.
From 0 to 9 as a very negative kind of thing.
Miserable.
Even at home was even worse. They liked distractions more than they liked their own thoughts. And then they do this thing. The researcher says, "I have to tell you, with my other co-authors, there was a lot of debate. Why are we going to do this?" Meaning the electric shocks. No one is going to shock themselves. And listen to this. To the researcher's surprise, the 42 people who said they would pay money to avoid the shocks, two-thirds of those people shocked themselves. They knew that they were going to experience physical pain because they were so uncomfortable with their own thoughts.
It
is unbelievable to me.
But think about it. You come to work, you're with your coworkers, you're on the computer a lot of the time, you walk into the house, which is quiet, you immediately turn on the radio or turn on the television, or we are constantly, you know, getting, when we're by ourselves, having some other sound. Thoreau is out there in the middle of nowhere with no noises but the birds, and of course he could be contemplative because he didn't have that option.
Okay, but wait a second. If this study said people would prefer to check their cell phone or listen to the radio then be alone with their own thoughts, I would have said, well, that's not surprising. We're in the era of distraction. They would choose physical pain knowingly, an electric shock administered to their ankles, rather than having to spend, what was it, 5 or 10 minutes contemplating their own thoughts. I mean, that to me is one of the most depressing.
When you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't get back to sleep and your mind starts racing, what are you usually thinking about?
I never wake up in the middle of the night. Okay. I wake up early. I do wake up early. I can sleep through anything.
Okay.
I wake up early, and I wake up earlier than everybody else because I want to be alone with a cup of coffee doing just this. Just what are you making a face? Just contemplating my own thoughts.
You aren't doing that for 2 seconds.
What are you talking about?
If you're waking up early in the morning with a cup of coffee, what else are you doing, Jim? Come on.
I may check my texts and my email a couple times.
Yeah. How many times you check
and
your text and email?
I may listen to 89.7 a little bit.
That's right.
Just to see what
no,
the
you're
morning
not quiet.
Noise is.
You're not quiet. You're not by yourself. If you don't wake up in the middle of the
night. But you are. You and Dan Harris, who wrote the, from ABC, wrote the book, what, 10% Better or whatever it is?
The Meditator Set.
You, the Meditators, can do this. And
well, that's
this.
What you do. You train your mind so that you can think of your mantra or think of your word, whatever you do, for 20 minutes or half an hour or something. But I think if you wake up in the middle of the night, most people that wake up in the middle of the night, their mind races. And it's mostly about, you know, their bills. They can't pay the bills, or the car's broken down. Their mind races. And it's like this series of disasters. And you can't get back to sleep. I mean, it's just like you're replaying the tapes over and over again, or you can't stand your boss, or you can't stand your spouse, and you're imagining telling the spouse off, or imagining telling the boss off, and you're wound up into a total, you know, frenzy, and you can't get back to sleep. People wake up and do that all the time. So I think the same thing is true in life. If you have to walk around the house in total quiet, or
for 5 minutes. For
well,
10
well,
minutes?
Look at people walking down the street now. Everybody's looking at their
that
cell phone.
That is true.
We don't want to have to do this. I find it a little extreme that you want to get, you know, tased practically to avoid these thoughts.
Marjorie comes to me with this story from the Globe this morning we were talking about, and she says, look at the line where it says discuss. You can discuss the story online, and the question is so perfect. Would you prefer an electric shock to quiet contemplation? It is so preposterous. But, you know, in light of the fact that an electric shock is something I assume the vast majority of people fear, it underlines the unwillingness, the discomfort that people feel being with themselves. So we want to know, which camp are you in? Virtually everybody in this laboratory study were in the camp that said, by the way, didn't matter what the demographic was, everybody preferred distraction, including, not everybody preferred the electric shock. Everybody preferred distraction over self-contemplation. And if you're in that school, why do you think you're in that school? And are you okay with that? 877-301-8970, one of the truly unbelievable studies of our time.
Let's start with Dan in Attleboro. Are you okay being alone, Dan, or not?
Hi, Dan.
I love being alone.
Really?
Why? Why are you the outlier here?
Well, I think I find it a little troubling that people can't spend, you know, 5 minutes on their own.
I do, too.
Contemplating. So it makes you wonder, like, are these people really focused people and, you know, What really are they thinking when they do have that 5 minutes alone? Like, do their brains just start to scramble on them and they say, oh, my God, I need something to focus on? Or?
Well, the Globe says we are in a mutually enabling relationship with technology, and I think that's true. And we are so tethered to the technology, was Marjorie was saying before, Dan, that I think we're uncomfortable when we're not doing what we're used to doing.
So, Dan, when you are alone, are you alone in the quiet, or are you alone with the music on, or what?
No, I don't mind. I don't mind it being quiet. I travel by myself. I've been around the world by myself. I've never felt uncomfortable about it. I've even come back, you know, coming back through Logan and had the security say to me, you know, how come you're alone? And I'm like, well, because it was a great vacation. I didn't have to worry about anybody else. I didn't have to listen to anybody complain about the food. I went and I did my own thing.
You know, Dan, I don't know you to give you advice, but I'm going to tell you, as good as that vacation was by yourself, try an electric shock. There's nothing quite... As Dan, thank you for the call. I want to be like Dan, by the way. How calm and relaxed and comfortable with himself did Dan sound?
I mean, he sounded very, very together. Too bad more of us can't be like
him. No, really, I am. Are you as stunned by the results of this
electric
as I am?
Electric shock? Yes.
Okay. 877-301-8970. Again, it's in the journal Science. This is not like Mad Magazine or The Onion. The vast majority of people were totally, in fact, everybody was uncomfortable contemplating their own thoughts. And when given the choice between contemplating their own thoughts and electric shock, a huge percentage chose the shock.
Gina from Pembroke, do you feel comfortable alone contemplating yourself or whatever you contemplate?
Well, I gotta say, it's hard, but I've been working on it. Marjorie, I know you meditate. I'm a beginner, and I've been trying to work on spending 1 to 2 hours a day in silence. And
wow.
It's very deliberate, because before I thought about doing it, I've always got music on. There's something in the background, but when you take that time to have it be in silence and just sit in your thoughts, it's really hard, but it gets easier the more you take the time to try and do that. It's very therapeutic.
Wow, so you're spending,
huge.
Yeah, so do you do this like an hour in the morning or an hour at night, or do you spend the night?
Yeah, sometimes in the morning, depends on the day, if how early I wake up. The morning's nice to be quiet, or when I'm cooking dinner, if I try and say, okay, I'm not going to listen to music right now, I'm just going to cook, you know, don't read, reading is kind of, you know, that's a little bit distracting.
Yeah.
But to really be, it's like a kind of an active meditation where you can be doing something, but, you know, you're just in silence.
Well, that's what the mindfulness, that's what the mindfulness people say. You know, you're supposed to really, okay, you're chopping the vegetables, really pay attention to chopping the vegetables. It's hard to pay attention to chopping the vegetables.
I find, in all seriousness, and thanks for the call, Gina. I've told you this, is one of the great relaxing things for me, and I do have a hard time relaxing. I do love chopping vegetables.
But you don't chop the vegetables in silence, I'm sure.
I usually am writing my notes for the show with one hand while I'm chopping with my left.
But think about
that. Can I read this line?
When you go into the house, though, how long are you in there before you...
Seconds. I know. I'm the worst. I mean, I was kidding before. I am the most distractible human. It's horrible, and I'm not happy about it. Let me read this line again, because I left out a key part of this that I can't believe you didn't add, because you love this. It's from the Globe story by Carolyn Johnson, we should have said. To the surprise of the 42 people who said they would pay, as $5, to avoid the shock, two-thirds of them chose the shock themselves, and a quarter of women did. Here's the part I left out. One person pressed the shock button 190 times. It's like waterboarding. It's like his name is, who was waterboarded down there 100 and some times.
It's like
Guantanamo.
That horrible experiment. Remember the guy that was shocking the person in the other room? These people, differently though, were shocking themselves. That's how horrible they find it.
And they knew, again, they knew that they would be administering an electric shock to themselves. It wasn't a surprise. It wasn't like someone said, press this button, you'll have a distraction. Press this button and you will have administered an electric shock to your own body, so that you don't have to spend time with yourself. It is, it's really as good a statement about where we are in 2014.
And they did say it hurt. It wasn't like,
that's
it wasn't
correct.
Like a little nothing shock.
Well,
that
guy wasn't sure the first 189 times if it hurt, so he wanted to try it one more time just to make sure it actually hurt.
Dennis from Wareham, what do you think about electric shocks versus spending time contemplating?
Hey, hi, Dennis.
I spend most of my time in the shop alone working all day. And when I get out of here, I'll go out in the woods, either in my kayak or fishing along some stream. I prefer to be alone.
What do you do in the shop, Dennis?
Millwork.
Millwork, yeah. Just, okay.
I make custom moldings and stuff.
But, okay.
More often than not, it's very noisy in there, of course, but I'm by myself. I'm with my own thoughts while I'm working with my machinery, but I much prefer to be alone.
So, Dennis, does your mind start to race sometimes about all, you know, the things you're worried about?
If I have a sleepless night, maybe, yeah, but not usually. Usually I'm planning ahead or thinking about things and just thinking about the book I'm reading, trying to figure out the plot or whatever, you know.
It's great.
Have you always been like this? Were you like this as a kid?
Oh, when I was a kid, I used to spend endless hours out in the woods by myself.
I am so envious.
So maybe this is like a personality
kind of thing
that if you did that as a child, it might continue
later
in your
life. Yeah, but Marjorie, that might be the explain if half of the people preferred an electric shock to self-contemplation.
You know, it's incredible.
This is an overwhelming number.
When I think of the times I've gone out to interview people in their homes, and they've got the television on.
Even if they're not watching it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm there doing the interview, and
it's part of the environment.
Like,
I know.
Blasting in the background. And I think, how can you have company over?
That's how I am with the radio. I have the radio on all the time. And it's not good. I know that. I know it's not healthy. I know it's not good. And it's surely... It's not good.
So what are you avoiding, Jim?
What?
What are you avoiding?
Contemplating my own life. That's, I mean, I don't know. And what are all these other people avoiding?
I don't know. Let's go to Joe and Cranston. What are you avoiding, Joe?
Hi, Joe.
Nothing at all. I could be quiet for hours on end.
Wow. Did you spend your childhood in the woods, too?
No.
So what do you think it is with you?
People have to be able to, first of all, stand back and... separate themselves from their thoughts. I mean, if your mind's racing, you have to be able to, I think, be dispassionate even about your own thoughts and be able to say, see, you know, if your thoughts are going anywhere productive. If they're not, dismiss them.
Wow, that is very difficult to do. I mean, think about, thank you for the call, Joe. Think about, say, in traffic, because you're one of these people that if someone, you know, cuts you off in traffic, you'll fall into Ohio to get
it
even.
Really is.
And while you're following them to Ohio, think about all the scenarios you play over and over again. The vengeful scenarios. And Joe says he can sort of stop those. That's not that easy to do. You know what I mean?
I know, but yes, I know exactly what you mean. And I know exactly what you mean. 877-301-8970. Let's take a couple more calls here. Again, if you just tuned in, this is in Stories in the Globe. It was published, a study was published in the journal Science suggesting that the vast majority of people in a laboratory preferred to administer an electric shock to themselves than to spend the time contemplating their own thoughts. Adam, you're on the road. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. Hi, Adam.
How you guys doing?
We're excellent.
I got to hurry because I'm going through a tunnel, but
yeah.
I just think I'm one of those people that I don't mind spending time by myself or with people. I think they're both very healthy. I think that we always try to choose a side, one side or the other, when we should try both, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the reason is just like a civilization society makes us like that, because there's so many large problems that have to do with living in a large society globally that we don't want to contemplate. So it's like it trickles down to now we do it for smaller things. But if you think of big things like the food we eat, where does it come from? The vast majority of people can't think about that because it would disgust them. You know,
that's
it. And like if you think about the human race being human beings in general are like overpopulating the planet, and how do you deal with a problem like that?
You know, I thought I was depressed when I heard about the electric shock, but Adam, you're totally right. I mean, they're huge problems. We can't deal with them, and we have small problems in our own lives. We can't deal with them, so what we do is we distract ourselves. I mean, this is really pathetic.
Now,
Adam, thank you.
Janine just emailed, and this is a point when you're raising your kids when they're small. She said, as a parent, she makes time for my children to have time alone with their thoughts so they can feel comfortable with themselves. Kids really are pretty wired up for the most part. So Janine's taking a different route. And Scott says, because I pretty much hate people, I much prefer the company of myself.
So beautiful. I don't think I was thinking what you say. I don't think I turned the television. Me and my mother had a couple of jobs, as I've told you, when she was raising me.
Yeah.
I don't think I turned the television off until I was 18. I mean, literally, from the time I came out of the womb until I left for college,
yeah.
I don't think the television was ever off in my house.
You know, I remember being in the first apartment I ever had that was
Where
on the first
this?
Floor. It was in Vermont.
Uh-huh.
And it made me nervous because it was on the first floor. And so when I would come home late at night, I would turn on the TV. Because I thought I couldn't be, you know, broken into or nothing bad could happen, you know, when the television was on, which was ridiculous, of course. But that it made me less nervous.
Because you feel like somebody's with you.
Exactly.
I mean, that is a huge part of the reason. It's the sound that makes you feel not alone, even though the vast majority of people have called.
Yeah.
And you, as a meditator, want to be, I mean, like being alone, yes?
Oh, no.
How did you make the conversion from that? Where you wanted the noise of the television so you weren't scared to the fact. I mean, I'm not disclosing anything you haven't talked about. You talked about when Dan Harris was here. You're a big-time meditator. You love it and you look forward to
it.
No, you are.
I realized that if I didn't intervene that, you know, my basket caseness was getting out of control. I didn't want to be a basket case for my whole life. So, but you have to learn how to do it, and it takes a long time. The Buddha talk about monkey mind, that if you stop and try to think about your breath, your mind is going 9,000 miles an hour. So it takes a long time till you can train your brain that you don't do that anymore. And I'm trained, Jim, I want you to know.
Mm-hmm.
I can do it for hours and hours and hours.
You know, I'm doing a 2:05 today when the show's over.
What?
Ministering an electric shock to myself. Just to say, I have to say, of all the stories we've done, this one is really right up there.
Okay, coming up, Burger King proudly serves a Whopper in ways you cannot even imagine. And the Pope finally meets with sex abuse victims. That's all next on All Revved Up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The days of kids going outside to play are becoming an antiquated concept. Today's challenge for parents is managing what's known as screen time. So what's the impact of all this technology on our kids?
We are conducting a vast uncontrolled experiment in sociology here by sort of dumping all this technology on us and what we choose to do with it.
I'm Bob C., a WGBH News focus on kids and technology. This afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
WGBH programs exist because of you. and the law firm of Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, providing counsel to companies and institutions for more than a century and proud to support WGBH. Innovative, dedicated, responsive. This is Nutter, on the web at nutter.com. And the Boston Speaker Series, proudly presented by Lesley University. 7 evenings at Symphony Hall, now in its 4th season. More information online at bostonspeakersseries.org. Sponsored by Dedham Savings.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For all the bold moves that Pope Francis has made over the year, from being, I don't know, a leader on poverty, to washing the feet of young prisoners, to excommunicating the mafia, today he's doing what so many were waiting for him to do, address the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandals head on. Today, as you know, he held his first meetings with victims of clerical sex abuse, pledging to carry forward the fight against the scandals that have rocked Catholicism. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about this, among other headlines, is Reverend Irene Monroe. She's a syndicated columnist who you can find at the Huffington Post and Bay Windows. We're also joined by Reverend Emmett Price. He's a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture, Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Good to see you both again.
Thanks for having us.
Good to see you. Thank you for coming in. So Jim just talked about Pope Francis, a meeting with the victims, one-on-one, up to a half hour apiece. But is this the beginning, the middle, the end? Is this enough? What do you think, Emmett Price?
Well, I think it's the middle. I mean, you know, I'm still in love with this Pope. I think he's doing great work. He's been in since March 2013. And usually when you take the lead of a huge organization, institution, they tell you don't do anything really dramatic in the first year.
Yeah.
You know, figure out what you're doing, where you are. So here he's now meeting with survivors. You know, he had, I think, a meeting with 6 individuals, had a group meeting last night, did a mass this morning, and then, individual meetings.
6 one-on-ones, yeah.
30 minutes each, mm-hmm. which I think is great.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great move. But I agree with SNAP, right, the Survivors Network of those abused by priests, that the folks in the Vatican, they already mm-hmm. know what happened. They don't need to have these kind of informational meetings, and they're looking for action. And so I think that at this moment, we're at the transitional moment where I think we need to see some results. We need to see some names on the list. We need to see some faces in the bullseye. You know, we need to see who are the folks that are going to be held accountable and to see some movement in this thing.
Irene Monroe, why do you think he's been, I think, ambivalent? And he's shown ambivalence on very few things. We all know the quote, which I think virtually everybody found offensive a few weeks ago when he's after the UN had their commission meeting. And he said that we're the most transparent organization in the world. We've essentially done more on this than anybody else. And other times he's called the sexual abuse crisis satanic. Today he apologized, expressed his sorrow. Why has he been all over the place, or has he been?
He has been all over the place. And part of the reason is because the church has really wrestled with this whole notion of sin and crime. And so they have, for a very long time, have dealt with these pedophilic priests that this is a sin, not understanding that, yes, it is a sin, but it's also there's a criminality to this. Part of it, to me, is that the church really has to work on a kind of new theology around human sexuality as well as gender equity. Well, while we have this now new commission that certainly will address child abuse.
Sean O'Malley is on it, by the way.
That's right, absolutely, with 7 other cardinals. Mm-hmm. We still have to do something about sexual assault and rape that goes on in the Catholic Church. The women who get raped, men who get raped, or sexually molested. So the church has a lot of work to do. By beginning with this, it really opens up some dialogue.
What does he have to do? I mean, by the way, I'm so glad you mentioned women. We have a friend who was a survivor of, mm-hmm. what's the name of the guy from Fall River?
Porter. Father Porter.
Father Porter, who regularly scolds us, even though she's a close friend of ours, for failing to mention that roughly a third of
were
the
women.
Victims of
mm-hmm.
these priests in this scandal were young women. So what is the walk that goes with the talk that shows that Francis is as serious about this, Irene Monroe, as he has been about so many other important
things? He's starting
things.
Some of it, and some of it falls sort of under this rubric of restorative justice. I mean, it's the intent to heal, repair together, move the church forward. And I think that in doing that, and the whole idea that the health and spiritual well-being of children really matters to us begins to open the door about then a further kind of dialogue about then how do we protect them? And in protecting them, how do we protect other members in the congregation? But it has to do a better job even in its seminary. It has to have a sort of faith-based sort of human sexuality curriculum and also a curriculum about, you know, church and clergy abuse. I think that what happens is that because of its insularity, it's become a haven, really, for sexual offenders.
But don't you think, at least I think, and a lot of other people, SNAP included, and Bishops Accountability, the great website, bishopaccountability.org, that has traced all these bishops who have moved priests around for years, including Cardinal Law, who was in Boston and has now got this great job at this unbelievably gorgeous
basilica. Is he still at the basilica, or has he been, is he still there?
I wasn't clear.
I think he is.
I could be wrong. And that is no, you know, that is not exactly being sent out to pastor.
Not
that
at
is
all.
A gorgeous, huge
yeah,
church.
It is.
They've got to, he's got to do something about these bishops.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, now's the time. I mean, if you think about this, there's protocol and procedure and policy already there. The question is, who's going to have the courage to step up and hold people accountable? And the challenge is always, what happens when you have to hold somebody who's higher rank or higher up on the food chain than you? Do you have the courage to do that? Time just released some information that said in the last 10 years, 3,420 credible charges have been referred to the Vatican. And to date, 824 of the clergy have been stripped of their office. And I mean, it's not enough,
yeah.
Right? And we have to do something now where you have a system of accountability, not okay. just process, procedure, protocol, but actually accountability.
You and know, they paid $2.5 billion to
the American church.
Compensation to the victims.
I just want to underline what Marjorie said because it's local. BishopAccountability.org is run by Ann Barrett Doyle. Has done, if you go to their website.
And Terry McKiernan.
And my apologies, you're right. Has done work that is epic. Now, I think you both made good points. One, it's a crime and it's got to be recognized as a crime, not just a sin. Two, that the higher ups, who maybe were not the perps, but shuffled around the perps, have got to be taken to task. One positive development locally, which we haven't mentioned on the show, which we should, Marjorie, because we were involved in this for a number of years, is the legislature finally acted on loosening. I don't know how far they went.
Yeah.
We'll check it out. The statute of limitations on child sexual abuse.
Right.
People like Carmen Durso, some of the lawyers who were involved with
really
the survivors'
hard.
Work
Mitchell
for
Garabedian.
Years. And that is a positive thing. So just one more thing. After he had these six one-on-one meetings, by the way, nobody from his home country of Argentina,
right.
there's a lot
right.
of complaining.
Right.
Nobody from the U.S. Well, actually, let's stay on that for a second. Why is that? I mean, in light of the fact that Sean O'Malley appears to be the driving force here
right.
to a great degree, I'm not suggesting or trying to minimize the horror of what happened elsewhere in the world. This is ground zero. It really is, this part of the country and this country.
Thank you.
Why do you think the United States was left out of this first round? And hopefully it is only a first round.
I think there's two things here. I mean, one, this issue, as much as we covered in the U.S., is an international issue. It's really big, right? And I don't want to minimize or diminish the impact in the United States. So I want to suggest that it's round one. Right. And don't forget that Marie Collins from Ireland is also part of that commission of driving force. She was a survivor. So it kind of sees where you have two people from Britain, two people from Ireland, two people from Germany kind of right there in that area. So I'm hoping that it's expansive. I think the other piece is that he kind of announced this kind of really quickly on his way back from another trip a week or so ago. So I'm hoping
that this
is... But
that's no excuse.
I think
the problem is that one, when you say U.S. Catholics, we're not, you know, they're not considered like really Orthodox Catholics, number one. And also, I think the United States, you're right, we're ground zero. You can't control this. You know, if you go exactly to ground zero and you don't have a certain protocol in place and you're trying to implement or start one, it's incendiary. I think he worries about it being, you know, explosive. He can control it.
So is that why, I mean, speaking of explosive, the place the Catholic Church is exploding most are places like Central America,
Absolutely.
South America, Africa. Interestingly, not just the U.S. was not in this list. Nobody from those countries or continents were there. Is that because he hopes to contain the story? I mean,
he might, but you know, there's another trend that's happening too.
What's that?
It's that a lot of folks have left the Catholic Church, and it happened long before, of course, the sex scandal. But that certainly exacerbated it a lot. So that's another thing. You have more sort of when you talk about certain countries, particularly Ireland, you're talking about a Catholic country,
right?
And when you're talking about the United States, you're talking about a more pluralistic or ecumenical kind of country, and also the way in which Catholics, you know, sort of practice their faith varies along various ethnic lines and class lines, and even from neighborhood to neighborhood. So, again, he can't control that. It's too incendiary. But so I can see why he certainly left the U.S. out, but it's no reason why I think, you know, that we should even think that he's going to come around and include us.
We're talking to Reverend Emmett Price and Reverend Irene Monroe.
So let's talk about the Hobby Lobby case. Oh. You guys are both reverends. Supreme Court decisions, everybody knows, which basically says that Hobby Lobby, this privately owned company.
That was Irene Monroe making that
I'm
sound.
Sorry.
You know, just
I'm
in case
sorry.
Since there's no camera.
Oh,
go
winning.
Ahead.
Yeah. It's like, yeah.
Winning, yes.
Oh, God.
The Hobby Lobby people have a right under freedom of religion, the constitutional right to say that we're not going to pay for contraceptives which they believe to be abortifacients. And that's controversial whether they are or they're not, like IUDs and morning after pills. But that was the ruling of the Supreme Court. So you've grown first, Irene Monroe. this is about freedom of religion.
So they say.
So
let's
they
just say that, okay.
Is they reverend? What is your take on this?
You know, the very interesting thing here, and I just have to say, for folks who are against abortion, I always say, then don't have one.
Right.
You know, it's as simple as that. The problem with this is just it's manifold in so many ways. One, we see more and more where the state has really given up its right to protect all its citizens. This is a collapse of church and state. Women of color have already had to deal with a long history of reproductive control at the hands of employees and government. This is another example, of course, with if we remember slave owners, you know, manipulating our reproductive rights, and Latin American women, Latino women, particularly in New York City, not having access to reproductive you know, contraceptive because they had too many children. So I think that, you know, again, we have a situation here where we see the eroding of civil rights gains that go back to the 60s, 1973, Roe versus Wade. I think the good thing that's coming out of this is that July 13th, Black Church is having a protest on this issue. And this is a real step because the Black Church at one point Hobby Lobby. And this is a great step.
Wait. In defense not of Hobby Lobby, the employer, but of the
Supreme Court decision.
Wait, I'm sorry. They're supporting the Supreme Court decision or protesting?
They're protesting.
Okay, I got it. I'm sorry. My apologies.
On July 13th. Okay. Yeah, they're protesting it.
Well, that's interesting because it's Black Church and they're you know, contraception is
a big, because it always used to be seen as a form of genocide.
Mm. Well, yeah, there's a big issue there with church people doing this. What do you think about this?
Well, I mean, here, it was the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Conference, which was founded in 2003 as the progressive African-American faith community, 501c3. And their argument is that this opens the floodgates to other forms of discrimination. In essence, that this opportunity to extend First Amendment rights to for-profit corporations and other organizations that are beyond churches and religious nonprofits creates a floodgate. In essence, they're saying that this is wrong. And regardless of how they felt in the past, and Irene is right, this is a huge moment that many of us have been waiting for us to say, okay, look, you may focus on one specific issue,
right,
but in the grand scheme of things, you know, we all have to stand together.
But it's a slippery slope, too. So this is how this looks like. You can say, because of my religious belief, I can't hire an LGBT person, or better yet, because of my religious belief, again, you know, around homosexuality, I can't dispense HIV/AIDS medicine.
We asked the constitutional law expert if that's not the other day, right after, if that's not a natural extension of this Hobby Lobby case, and he said that it is reasonable to think that that's one of the next challenges that we'll hear.
There was a letter that went out on July 1 by a number of evangelical preachers, and Rick Warren was part of this letter. D. Michael Lindsay, the president of Gordon College, which actually asked President Obama not to prevent federal funding to organizations who actually do want to make that kind of statement.
That's right. And see, and it looks another way. So it could say, because of my religious belief and the whole idea of wanting to uphold the integrity and value of the family, I'm not going to hire, you know, a single mom. Because really, first of all, she shouldn't be single and she should be home with her child. So it's just a slippery slope that I felt that it was fortified first with the decision to abolish buffer zones, number one. And what really hurt my feelings was that it was unanimous vote.
Three women.
You had the three women.
For it.
And then for Ginsburg to say, well, give a dissenting voice, I'd rather have her dissenting vote. I mean, what did that do? You know, so I'm just surprised. I mean, it fortifies and strengthens this sort of what I describe as a war on women.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that in the majority opinion, the writers were not. Who wrote the majority opinion? Was it Scalia?
No, Alito.
Alito. I'm sorry. So, you know. Went out of his way to say that this is not about homosexuality. But
please, okay.
And well, then, so like, as Ginsburg pointed out in her dissent, that what about Jehovah's Witnesses who don't want
blood
transfusions?
That's right.
What about Scientologists who don't like antidepressant drugs? So I thought it was interesting that they and there were five Catholics, by the way, on the Supreme Court and the Hobby Lobby.
Can I say something? I think we need term limits on the Supreme Court.
Oh, I wonder who has advanced that notion in the studio nonstop.
Five terms is 20 years. That's enough because just think of Clarence Thomas. He comes in at 43.
Right.
Okay. Chances are he still might be in his right mind. It's questionable, but at 83, I mean, that's 40 years. That's just too much
control.
Well, can
I tell you, I am a huge believer in that. We asked Larry Tribe, who has a little bit more constitutional expertise than the four of us from Harvard Law School the other day. And Larry Tribe's position is the perfect compromise are 18-year terms, which would allow, and I hope I get this right, allow virtually every president, because obviously they'll expire at certain times, to make a couple of appointments. So because you make the point, which I think is an important one, Irene Monroe, about young people appointed, whether they're of the right or the left, they could serve potentially through eight presidents. But think about it for a minute. Let's assume Barack Obama, before he left office, you've speculated, does Ruth Bader Ginsburg step down? She's in her 80s. She's had cancer a couple of times. Does she step down so that he can pick somebody to replace her? He picks a 45-year-old woman, let's say, who's liberal-leaning. As much as that may please an Irene Monroe, let's assume there are eight conservative presidents picked in a row. Is that really what America wants?
That's right.
If they've decided democratically that's who they want to lead their country, is it right that somebody, and I know theoretically they're above politics, but I am totally with you.
But
I
the
think
Supreme
a real
Court
issue.
Has now become, in my opinion, the right wing of the Republican Party. I just, again, I mean, we can't get away from this war on women. It's really saying biology is destiny.
You think there's a war on women there at Price?
Well, I mean, I see a little bit bigger than that. I think there's a war on complacency. You know, and when I say complacency, I think folks want it the same old way, the way it's always been. And there's a war to keep it that way, right?
That's always been a war on women.
And I think that's what, I think it's bigger than that.
You got to walk out of the studio with me, Emmett, okay? I just need to tell you this, okay? It's going to be a war. It's on now.
Marjorie has my back.
Now, you say when you walk out of the studio. When you walk out of the studio, you know where you should walk, Irene Monroe? Right over to Burger King.
Okay.
Now, people, you want to tell the story out of San Francisco? I love this.
This is a great story. Burger King is promoting this LGBT equality with the release of what they call the Gay Pride Whopper. Here's the deal. The Miami-based Burger King is Miami-based. I didn't know that. But they rocked the world. They had this proud Whopper that they debuted at the San Francisco restaurant along the route of the city's 44th Gay Pride Parade. And the Whopper has a slogan, and it's called Be Your Way, as opposed to what's the regular slogan?
Have it your way.
Have it your way.
So, but there's another great part before you finish.
What?
Is that it says on the wrapper, introducing the Proud Whopper. So I saw a television story where it might have been the great Jeannie Most from CNN, I'm not sure, but it was somebody who had her sense of humor who was saying she was watching people opening it, saying introducing the Proud Whopper. And he said, what do you think of it? And everybody said, well, it's the exact same Whopper as it was before. And when you open it, it says we're all the same inside.
That's right.
Now,
that's right.
Irene Monroe, let me start with you. I think these kinds of things actually matter. They're
that's
on
right.
the margins, but the average person goes to Burger King. They see this. They see a major corporation. Since major corporations have all these rights now, at least let them do something good. Doesn't this have a trickle-up or trickle-down effect?
You know what's so wonderful? It's counter to Chick-fil-A, who makes a statement that we don't want gay employees.
Yep.
You don't want to spend your pink dollars there. It's a wonderful statement in terms of we recognize that we have gay patrons, we have gay employees, and the statement. I love the statement. We are all the same, mm-hmm. but the wrapping is just a tad different.
So what do you think of this?
I love it. I mean, I think the timing is great. You know, I used to live in the Bay Area, and that Pride Parade is huge. And mm-hmm. so I think the timing of the launch was great. And also, Irene mentioned the Chick-fil-A thing that happened back in July 2012. And I thought this was interesting because earlier this year, back in March, the president's CEO, Dan Cathy, actually kind of said that he made a boo-boo by taking the corporation and being vehemently opposed to the same-sex marriage piece. And I would assume that's because
he lost money. There wasn't a change in moral consciousness at all.
And he says he doesn't apologize for the statements he made, but to bring his company to be a part of that, you know, 2 years later, that's interesting. So I love this move.
So
I hope Berkeley is successful.
To talk to.
But it is San Francisco. It is San Francisco.
That's right. It was just for the month of June.
So yeah.
It's honoring our struggle.
So you two were talking about, before you leave, you're talking about Pope Francis walking the walk, not just talking the walk. Let's see if you walk the walk. When was the last time you had a Whopper, Emmett Price?
Oh, man, it's been about 9 or 10 years.
You should be ashamed of yourself. How about you, Irene Monroe? There used to be one right in Central Square.
Sadly, it's gone. And since it's gone, I've been meeting you at Whole Foods at the hot bar.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
Okay,
and I have a Fitbit.
Fine.
I need to have the Pride French fries. Maybe I could get behind the Pride French fries.
I don't know if I can do a Whopper anymore.
Can I just say right here that anybody who does not prefer the fire grilled Whopper to the Big Mac doesn't know anything about hamburgers. Can we just leave it right there?
Okay, Jim.
Trust me on this.
All right, you guys.
It's one of my few areas of expertise.
Thank you very much for coming in. Irene Romero, a syndicated columnist. You can find her at the Huffington Post and Bay Windows. The Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Up next, has getting lost taken on a whole new meaning in the era of the GPS, microchipping, and heavy surveillance? If we're not sure where we are, is someone else keeping track of us? What it means to lose yourself in the 21st century is the subject of a new book by the Boston Globe's Hiawatha Bray. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
One more story.
We all go through tests in life, and this is my test. And at the end of passing my test, I will have a story to tell somebody.
The special risk of living with cancer as an African-American woman under her skin living with breast cancer. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
Support for WGBH comes from you and the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, proudly supporting All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6 p.m., here on 89.7 WGBH. And the Summer Investigative Reporting Workshop for high school students at Boston University, where students learn critical thinking and research skills, how to do in-depth reporting, interviewing, and more. NECIR.org/summer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. The missing Malaysian jet, which is, you know, disappeared 3 months ago, is almost an anachronism given that we are living in an era where it seems technologically impossible to lose anything, from microchipping our pets to apps that let us find our misplaced belongings to surveillance technology that knows where we are even when we don't. The notion of losing something, or ourselves, in fact, seems improbable. How we've gotten to this place, coordinates and all, is the subject of Hiawatha Bray's great new book. It's called You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. Hiawatha, as you know, is a technology columnist for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, it's great to have you.
Great to be here.
Thank you very much for being here. So, Hiawatha, you go way back into ancient times.
Back.
So before we get to where we are now with the GPSs and cell phones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, tell us, mankind has been trying to locate ourselves and locate other places forevermore. So tell us a couple of your favorite innovations along those lines from way back in our history.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I was just fascinated by all kinds of things. One of my favorite paradoxes is the fact that what we now think of as latitude and longitude is this amazing dual problem that people have been grappling with for millennia. And the funny part is, latitude was easy. People within, like, almost like, what, 5,000 years ago, people had a fair idea of how you calculated latitude, because what you had to do was find a point in the heavens as close as possible to due north, and then you could, even by doing something as simple as holding a string between your teeth and holding it up to see the angle between the star and the horizon, you could figure out how far north you were from the equator. And people knew how to do that forever. Some of the most early navigational stuff was incredibly primitive. What was his name? Eratosthenes, the guy who first figured out the circumference of the earth. He just used some sticks, basically, and a well. And he was just looking at the angle of the light hitting these sticks at different times of day in two different locations. And just from using trigonometry, he was able to calculate the circumference of the planet to within, like, about a couple of hundred miles. He was incredibly
accurate.
And he
did it, like, when did he do it? Like,
oh, wow. It was like about, oh,
way
I forget.
BC.
Way BC.
Way but BC.
It was,
okay.
It was like something 100 BC.
Well, let's talk biblical. You told me a great story the other day. Talk about primitive moments. You told me the bird story about...
Oh, yeah.
Tell that story here, if you
will. Oh, no. Well, it's just that we know that at least one recorded case of a Viking navigator using the same technique that we see in the book of Genesis. I didn't see that movie, Noah, by the way. I understand a lot of people had problems with it. But if you know the story of Noah, there's this whole idea that Noah released a bird to decide whether or not there was any dry land left. The idea was the bird would fly and he'd watch the direction the bird flew in. And if the bird came back, there was no place for the bird to land. If the bird didn't come back, they sailed in that direction. We know the Vikings, at least one of them, actually used that technique to find land when they were navigating around in northern climates and actually eventually getting over to North America. They would just release a bird and see if it flew and disappeared, and then they'd follow it. And it worked. You had people following in the Pacific. You had the Laputa people who colonized all the islands throughout the Pacific, following schools of fish as one of their techniques for navigating. So people were using everything they could think of to try to find their way around the world.
And why is it, what did it mean if you followed a school of fish? Tell people. Explain that.
Well, no. It's basically that would give you some idea that there was you could just figure out whether or not they were heading toward a particular coral reef or something like that. I mean, it was mainly a matter of experience, though. What you're talking about is that these are people who learned from over years of experience over time that in this particular part of the ocean, a particular school of fish, if you saw it, would tend to be moving north or south, and you would know to follow that school of fish to go in a particular direction. Because at this point, they didn't have things like compasses that hadn't been developed yet.
We're talking to Hiawatha Bray from The Globe. His book, You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History and Future of How We Find Ourselves, is a terrific read, I should say. So one of the depressing, I don't know if it's depressing, one of the eye-opening things to me, at least, is a huge percentage of what we have now that makes it virtually impossible for us to become lost, whether we want to be or not, is a function of what the military needed to do its job. If we had not, I know this is almost preposterous, if we had not had wars, where would we be in 2014 in terms of this technology?
Oh, well, it's not just 2014. I mean, if you think about it throughout history, just the classic example is the map. I mean, maps throughout history have been treated like almost like state secrets, because simply having an accurate map of a particular country gave you a huge military advantage. So all along, navigational knowledge has had a military component and also a trade component. It also gave you a competitive advantage. I mean, you had all these traders in Renaissance Italy competing to create the best maps and keeping a lot of their knowledge secret. And so a lot of their mapping knowledge would be kept as closely held as possible because they didn't want a competing trader to know the best way to sail to the Indies.
How did they create those, Matt? How accurate were they in the earlier days? Give me a time. Well, and how did they create them?
Well, a lot of it's word of mouth. I mean, basically, it's ironic because maps are always like that, and they still are to this day. You talk to people who've been there, and you get their information. And the best maps were made by people who would travel to various places and take copious notes and write down everything they could as precisely as possible. And ironically, we are still doing that to this day. If we can move into the modern era for a second. If you use Google Maps, for example, there is a feature on it called Map Maker. Suppose you see something that isn't there or something that's incorrect. You can open up your browser or your smartphone and you can tell Google, this should be on the map, or what you've got there is wrong. This business is now closed. And you can personally redraw the map. One of the things that has happened in our modern time is that we are all now in the position of some, like, we're like Marco Polo, who goes out and goes through Asia and writes down what he sees, and people start trying to design maps for that. Now we're all in that position. We go through the world. I was in Kinshasa, Democratic Republic of Congo, last year, and I'm wandering around. I said, oh, wait a minute, that street corner there, that building is not on my map. And I sat there and I wrote it down and I sent it to Google. It's on the map now.
That is great.
Did Google double check this, or did they take your word for it, Hiawatha?
They do. It depends. Now, that's interesting. I don't know how they do it in Kinshasa. In other parts of the world, they check it. It's all over the map. You may have heard of an organization called OpenStreetMap. Now, that's a very interesting example. OpenStreetMap was founded by a British guy who wanted to design his own maps of Britain, and he wanted to base them on the British Ordnance Survey maps. But in Britain, that's copyrighted. He would have had to buy them. By the way, that's not true in the U.S. Federal government maps, that's all open source. You can use as much as you want, but in Britain, you had to buy them. So he said, the heck with it. Let's give everybody a GPS, and we're going to get a bunch of British volunteers. We're going to create our own map of Britain. And it worked. And then they spread it around the world, and now you can get most of the world mapped by volunteers who just walked around with GPS and notepads writing this stuff down. And there are people doing that worldwide. And major corporations, including people like MapQuest, now use this map as their basic map because it's so accurate. It's the Wikipedia of maps, and people just go out and do it themselves.
We're talking with Hiawatha Bray from the Boston Globe, who's written a terrific new book, You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. Before we get again to where we are now, I just want to know, when you were researching this, what did you think? Were there one or two things that had the most impact in bringing us to where we are now in terms of being able to find ourselves and not be able to get lost anymore? Was there some, like, one or two heroes that you just really loved?
Well, the things that really jumped out at me are the invention of the airplane and the invention of radio, because those things really come together at about the same moment in history, and they really transform everything, and they sort of depended on each other. Because one of the first things that happens when you have an airplane is suddenly people realize everything we use for finding our way around, suddenly it becomes very limited or even completely useless when you're doing it from 1,000 feet up. Like maps. You have to completely rethink maps because you have to draw the map in terms of, first of all, you got to draw it so it doesn't get blown out of the plane when you're sitting there looking at it. But secondly, what do things look like from 1,000 feet up? You've got to redesign all the maps to deal with that. But also, you've got the larger problem that people first began to grapple with in World War I. You know, we're right now at the anniversary of World War I, and this is when people really begin to understand that aerial navigation has become a life or death issue, literally. And things like, how do you fly at night? How do you fly through clouds? And so on. And so the effort to solve that never was completely successfully solved in World War I. You were talking about warfare, but actually, in a very important sense, commerce turned out to play an even more important role in getting aviation navigation off the ground. And you know who was really responsible for a lot of it? What institution led the way? One of the most enlightened progressive institutions known to man? The post office. It's shocking, isn't it? The post office led the way. No, because what happened was they had to figure out how to fly mail. Airmail.
Oh, gosh.
And just figuring out how to fly airmail, many of the problems involved in navigating from the air were solved in the quest to get airmail right. Because if you couldn't fly at night or in bad weather, airmail was useless. Because otherwise the train, which would keep going under all conditions, was faster than a plane. So they were getting guys killed left and right. Dozens of men died flying airmail routes, and they had to figure out a way to fix this problem. And you get guys like Herbert Hoover, who everybody thinks of as some backward stick in the mud. Herbert Hoover was a brilliant man. He was an engineer, and he's sitting here trying to figure this out. And he is pushing to get this done. And first they build this network of acetylene torches, basically, giant acetylene torches running across the country so the pilots could see by night as they flew along through these torches. But then later, of course, radio kicks in, and you start getting this concept of flying down the radio beam. And they build a network of radios that were the first radio method for navigating across the country. And that really is when you start to get navigation as what we now start to think of as a high-tech kind of thing, where you just point at a particular direction and the radio waves tell you whether you're flying in the right direction. And you don't even have to see where you're going. And so you get guys like, of course, Jimmy Doolittle. And everybody knows Jimmy Doolittle. He's a war hero. That's not the most important thing he did. The Doolittle raid had almost no military effect at all, even though he won the Medal of Honor for it. What he did, he was the first guy to fly a plane completely blind. He figured out how to do it. He helped design the engine, the equipment. Jimmy Doolittle was an MIT-trained aeronautical engineer. Everybody forgets that. And he helped design the technology which is used to this day so that you can fly a plane at night or in the dark and take off and land and never see anything.
When you said everybody forgets it, that's untrue. Some of us didn't know it until a second ago, Hiawatha Brake.
You didn't know about MIT.
I didn't know that he had an MIT connection. So would you, if you had been invited onto the unending CNN coverage of the, and it was a trial, obviously, 239 people still missing, so I don't mean to make like of it. Absolutely. If you had been invited on to CNN for the Malaysia Flight 370 to nonstop discussions, would you have been as off base and as clueless as they were? And how is it in 2014 that a plane can go out over an ocean and all of a sudden we lose track? We don't have the technology to follow them like we have the technology to follow you wherever you go. Well, How's that possible?
They do have the technology. They just didn't use it, as
Why
we now know.
Well,
you know about Inmarsat. Inmarsat has this satellite network that can basically talk to planes anywhere in the world. And many planes, including, as I understand it, this particular plane, have the hardware built in so that they could have activated a feature that would simply have automatically pinged the satellite with the aircraft's direction, location, speed, all that stuff.
Anywhere.
On a regular basis. That technology exists. Many planes use it, but it costs something. Inmarsat charges, I forget what it is, a certain amount of money per year if a plane wants to use that. They just announced in the aftermath of this, from now on, it's going to be free. So if you have the plane equipped with their satellite equipment and you just sign up for this service now and it's free, as soon as that plane leaves the ground, it's constantly pinging. It's saying, here I am, here I am, here I am. The technology most certainly exists. People weren't using it because of this one simple, I think, basic sense that we had that the modern commercial airliner is insanely reliable, which, in fact, it is. Millions of these things. I mean, at any given day, thousands of airplanes are flying these kinds of routes, and they just do it every day without any problems at all. Planes just don't disappear. We should have been warned when Air France 447 disappeared, and it took 5 days to find it. That should have warned people, but it didn't. And now this has happened, and I think that's over now. We will never again see this happen. I don't know if it's happened. I don't know if the transition's finished, but I guarantee you that if not, within a year or so, every plane doing long transatlantic flights, they're going to be online.
We're talking with Hiawatha Brake, whose new book is You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History and Future of How We Find Ourselves. Hiawatha, you end your book with this sentence. They know where to find us, and they always will.
Yep.
So you've thought about this nonstop for months and months and months. Is it a good thing, bad thing, mixed thing that they know where to find us?
I keep thinking it's up to the way we regulate and control this stuff, because I don't see how it goes away. Obviously, a major part of my book involves the cell phone, which we haven't even talked about yet.
Right.
The cell phone changes everything. It did from the moment it became a commonplace feature of our lives, because this is not like, you know, surveillance kind of stuff. It's essential to the way it works. For a cell phone to work, it has to know where you are within at least a mile or so. But then in 1996 or so, the FCC took the next step. And this is one of those moments that really had a transforming effect on navigation. That was when they realized everybody's getting cell phones. If somebody is in an emergency and they dial 911, how do we find them? And so they issued this order saying by a certain year, I forget what it was, the early 2000s, all phones are going to have a way so that when you dial the number, people will know where you are.
And it was a function of the 911 issue that on
Absolutely.
Landlines, they obviously knew where you were,
Absolutely.
But they didn't know where you were on a cell phone.
That is exactly what happened. They said, we have got to find a way to solve that problem.
Could you get lost if you wanted to?
Oh, yeah, sure.
How?
Well, no, I mean, you don't have to take your phone with you, for one thing.
Well, how about your picture being snapped? I mean, my favorite number, what we talked a couple of years ago,
300.
Great Britain, this was years ago, 300 times a day your picture is taken on the streets of London. I mean, how does one, if one wants to get lost, how does one do that?
Well, no, we're still, I think, in the security through obscurity phase in this case, because there are so many cameras out there. I don't think we have anywhere near that level of photography. But even if we did, it's going to be hard to plow through all those pictures to identify a particular person. But that's a problem that will eventually go away as our computers become more and more powerful and they apply more and more of them to the problem. In theory, they could follow you down the street. And in fact, there are already people working on stuff like that where you get your picture taken at one camera. And they already do it in retail stores. You can walk into a retail store, they take a picture of your face, and the cameras in the store follow you based on looking at your face. Could they do that in an entire city full of people? Yeah, to some extent, but I don't think it's anywhere near perfect yet. But I get your point. The point is, it's only going to get better. They're only going to get better and better at it. They now have algorithms where if your face is turned to the side, they can still recognize you. It can infer what the rest of your face looks like with very high accuracy. So you're absolutely right. There's that. There's the phone. And now, of course, you have things like license plate scanners. You are simply driving down the street and they are taking pictures of your license plate. That one's really scary because if there's no regulation requiring that they discard those records after a certain period of time, they can retroactively follow you around now. They can go back and say, well, where was he on June the 13th? And actually at least follow your car.
So it sounds like what you're saying, Hiawatha Bray, is big picture, it's a mixed bag.
It's a very mixed bag.
On the one thing, we don't have to stop at the gas stations anymore to get directions. On the other hand, people can find us, know where we are 24/7.
Heck, if you pull in the gas station, they're liable to say, oh, well, you already know where you want to go.
Hiawatha Bray, before you go, tell us the story you told me on television the other night, just because we're going to talk about, in a minute after you go, with listeners about our over-reliance, I would suggest, on things like GPS technology. Knowing you as we do from afar, reading your stuff, we would assume that would never happen to you, but actually it did on a trip to Chicago. Did it not?
Of late?
Tell people your own story so you know that you're a mere mortal, like just all the rest
of us. Well, no, it was like really kind of clueless because we were driving to Chicago, my wife and I, and we crossed over into Canada just for the fun of it. And I was relying on my GPS navigation, and all of a sudden it stopped working. And I'm going, wait a minute, I'm lost, what am I going to do? And it finally occurred to me, I'm in Canada. My phone service doesn't work in Canada. And without my phone service, it can't constantly respond and send me fresh mapping data. And all of a sudden, it was just totally ridiculous, and it hadn't occurred to me.
It would never occur to me either, because I thought the same satellites are up in the sky above Canada that are up above the United States.
No, when you're using your phone, you're not just using the satellite. You're also getting the data from like Google or Apple, and they're transmitting that over the phone
network. Does your GPS work in Canada?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yes, it does. And here's the other point.
I just
wrote about
this.
This
weekend.
What you do is you download an app that will allow you to get a map of, say, wherever you're going, stored on the phone that is not reliant on the phone network. So that all it is, now it just acts as a pure GPS device. And there are a number of apps like that, I've written about them, where you can just download a map of whatever country you're going to be in. And even if you don't have phone service, you can still use your phone to navigate. But you better get one.
So did you have to stop at a gas station in Canada to ask how to get back?
Yep.
Did you really?
Like the old days,
Hiawatha.
Yep. When I was
you
a
and
mere
your wife
boy.
Have an argument about this for 15 miles before you did?
We were laughing about it. I said, you idiot, you idiot. She said, oh, you think you know everything. And I'm like, no, I had no idea.
Well, Hiawatha Bray, a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on a terrific book. I'm always so impressed when people can be newspaper writers and newspaper columnists and write their books on the side. I wish I could get so organized. Anyway, Hiawatha Bray's new book is You Are Here, From the Compass to GPS, The History of the Future and the Future, the history and future of how we find ourselves. Thank you very much for being here,
Hiawatha.
Up next, we're going to ask you, when was the last time you got lost, as in really lost? Has GPS technology changed the way you move throughout the world? Do you no longer have to degrade yourself and ask for directions at gas stations? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I support WGBH for a number of reasons.
WGBH sustainer Chris DeWitt from Wrentham, Massachusetts.
You know, there's no place else I can go to where folks so clearly just celebrate the joy of knowledge. And it's great to be part of a group of people who are just like, I just want to find out just for the sake of knowing it.
Show your support at WGBHnews.org.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and North Shore Music Theater. Disney's The Little Mermaid is coming to life at Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater. The Under the Sea musical is at North Shore Music Theater from July 8th to 27th. NSMT.org. And UMass Lowell offering part-time graduate and undergraduate degrees online or on campus. Fall classes start September 3rd at UMass Lowell. You can learn more at continuinged.uml.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Now it's your turn. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. We were just talking with Hiawatha Bray about his new book, which looks at how we're relying on technology to find our way from the early days of navigation with a compass to today's omnipresent GPS. So we're coming off a holiday weekend where lots of us were driving. Did you get lost? Did you get really lost? Or has the GPS changed your life when it comes to getting from one place to the next? Could you go anywhere in 2014 without it? And if you've ever had a dispute, has this ever happened to you, Marjorie, where you've disagreed with the direction
right.
that the GPS provides, whatever the voice happens to be? Do you depend on the GPS or your own sense of place? 877-301-8897. We've both had experiences. I had one driving to Maine a couple of years ago. I don't remember where yours was.
I was late at night with one of my kids. It was
GPS
terrible.
Crashed.
It crashed.
No idea.
No
Gas
idea.
Stations closed.
Yep.
No idea how to get
Horrible.
Anywhere.
Horrible.
The dependence level is stunning. And by the way, if you're 20 years old and listening to the show, you didn't live in an era when this technology didn't exist. We did, and I'm sure a lot of listeners did too. When, as you said, to Hiawatha, you have to go to the gas station and ask the guy or the woman at the gas station. That's what we all did.
Yeah.
Or we unfolded maps from our glove
and
compartment.
I asked about him and his wife because that was the classic thing where
right.
the husband would never want to stop and ask directions. He was going to tough it out, and the wife would always say, sweetheart, we've been driving in circles for an hour. Let's pull over now. No. So it was always this macho thing with the directions.
So would you say it's a good thing that we
God, yes.
No, but good or that we never have to rely on ourselves for that, so we have the ability to spend our time doing other things? Or is it a problem, I think I'm with you, or is it a problem we don't have any ability?
We don't know how to get anywhere anymore.
Exactly.
That's a problem.
Should we worry about that or not?
I don't worry about it at all. You know why?
No.
Because the best thing is, if you go someplace else, say you fly to San Francisco and you get in the airport, excuse me, and you got the GPS in the car, it's totally stress-free.
Oh,
you're not like in a panic. How do I get to the hotel or how do I get wherever I'm going to go? And also, it's kind of fun. You know, you get the estimates what time you're going to get there. You know, if you set in a destination, do you beat the time? Do you not beat the time? The newer ones, I just got a newer one, tell you about the traffic and congestion and stuff. I absolutely love I feel like it's changed my whole life.
Did you just say California is what you're talking about? I hate to do this because every time I do it, you make fun of me, but
uh-huh.
I have no choice.
Oh, here we go. When I was in Paris.
I was in France a couple of years ago.
At the cafe.
It wasn't in Paris. It was on
having
the outskirts.
My espresso.
I was in the
in
most rural part of France.
Were you wearing a beret?
I actually looked fetching in a beret, to tell you the truth. No, I was not wearing a beret. I was on my way to, what's a place called? Mont Saint-Michel, whatever
Mont Saint-Michel.
It's called. Okay, I was on my way there, and the GPS, I am on a road on a farm that is about two-thirds as wide as the car that I had rented, which is a fairly tiny car. In the middle of nowhere, it's on the GPS.
It's great.
You say to yourself, it is unbelievable. You're in the middle of this country that is not yours. And, of course, we all think everything is less civilized than ours, which is totally insane. In the middle of nowhere, and this little path, it's not even a road, is on the GPS. But it does worry me. I don't know why, but it is so. Well, I do know why, because we both independently had the same experience. It broke down, and we had no ability to navigate or do
awful.
Anything. It's scary, actually.
And also, when you depend on the GPS, you forget how to get places. So you could have driven someplace. Like, I've driven to one of my kids' colleges a million times, and one day, I don't know what happened, but I didn't have the GPS.
And you couldn't
I
get
couldn't
there.
Remember how to get there.
Well, can I tell you the flip side
like
of the story?
Times.
Flip side is every day when I drive to NECN from uh-huh. here, my nighttime job, I've driven it for 15, whatever number of years. So I've never used the GPS. One day I decided, or maybe the GPS was still on from the morning. So that's what it was. And I realized that the GPS had a route that was different from the route that I had taken every day even before I worked at GBH, obviously 15 years. You know what? It was a mile and a half shorter. I mean, how incredible is that after a decade and a half of your life? And by the way, it's a 25-minute ride. It isn't like I'm going to Kansas.
You know what else is great? You know, there would be places you'd go. I was going someplace in Wayland or Weston, one of those W places one day. And it, usually they say, oh, take the Mass Pike or take 128 or something. The GPS sent me through the back roads.
I love that.
How fun is that to go through all the back roads? You've never been.
You know, we can do that. When it says, if you do you want to take a toll road? And if you say no, you get the back roads. Great.
Yeah. Well, they sometimes send you in the back roads, and it's sort of exciting to see other, you know, you could spy on other people's houses and check out the way they had their lawns done and all that kind of stuff.
Before we get to the calls, we will in 10 seconds, 877-301-8970. Do you have a man or a woman's voice?
I wish I had John Cleese, the guy from...
$10. I had him on my last GPS.
Yes, right now I have a woman. It's not a very good voice.
She's not very good?
What do you have?
I don't remember. 877-301-8970. How dependent are you on your GPS?
Oh, my goodness, Jim.
Could you exist without it? And does it make you nervous that you probably couldn't exist without it? Let's start in Marion with Tyler. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Tyler.
Hey, how are you, Jim and Margie? I'm good.
Excellent.
First I wanted to say I'd want Morgan Freeman's voice for my GPS. If I could have an option of it.
I'd like that one too.
That would be good. That would be good. Very reassuring.
Oh yeah, just would make you feel like you're going the right way all the time. But so this is a story of when me and my friend were going to Connecticut for a basketball tournament. He was in. We ended up getting into Hartford. We get completely lost. Like, we've already been on the road for 3 hours. We get into Hartford, get lost for 2 more hours.
We end up
in the middle of the ghetto. And now we're at a pawnbroker, and we don't know where we're going. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to go in and talk to these guys, see if they can give me more instructions. I go in there, and this guy with these at least 4-inch-long fingernails on each hand just types out on MapQuest for me where we need to go and gives me out a MapQuest printed out instruction. It was perfect. And
how long ago was this? Tyler, how long ago was this?
Oh, this was about 3-4 years ago.
So why were you GPS free? Why was there no GPS?
Neither of us had smartphones at the time.
Okay.
And this is actually a point where we were like, we don't need smartphones. We're just hold this bag of anything, and then it ended up being lost for so long.
Now, Tyler, that's the great.
You know, I had the experience, and that's what you don't get, you know, anymore with us GPS. That's what I did like, because I get to meet those people and have a fun story.
Now, I feel horrible that I haven't been to a pawn shop with guys with 4-inch nails in ages. Tyler, thanks for the call. What's that remind you of, Getting Lost? This is pre-GPS, my favorite book, Bonfire of the Vanities. Remember when
he takes the wrong turn in the Bronx.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it gets in big trouble.
Yes, he does.
Scott just emailed and said, last weekend I got lost walking 4 dogs on 2,600 acres of the Middlesex Fells. He was lost for 6.5 hours. They had lots of water, but it was and plenty of shade, but it was really nerve-wracking. That was like the people that got lost in the cornfield. Remember that? They had to call
the cops.
Oh, you
did a great story about that.
I did a story about these people got lost in a cornfield, and they had to call the cops.
Not a corn. What are those things called? The mazes. The corn maze, yeah.
Yeah.
I love the thing. There was a picture on the front page of the Herald of Marjorie standing atop the corn maze with, you know how you put your hand over your head when you're looking into the distance trying to figure out where
right.
you are?
It's one of my finest pieces of investigative work.
I like to see you in the middle of a corn maze,
by
the way.
I was there. I was a little nervous.
She was there for months, actually. Let's go to Joanne.
From Cambridge. What do you think, Joanne?
Hi, Joanne.
You guys are so pathetic.
Thank you. We appreciate it. We accept the judgment.
You're so pathetic. You can't live without a GPS.
Yeah. Can't.
I do not own one. I have friends who have them in their cars, and they can't get from point A to point B without some sort of problems. And Saturday, a friend and I were going out. I am still Google Maps. That's what I use. I figure out where I'm going. And I don't have to worry about getting lost. If your GPS goes out, people have no idea what to do. You're all so pathetic. You're all pathetic.
We got it, Joanne. Yeah. We got to your point. We are pathetic.
Remember when you go get those
thank
big,
you for
huge,
a great call.
You go to AAA and get the big, huge maps of New
those.
England.
And if you
and
belong
then
to AAA,
and
you got it.
Folding them,
the
you can
triptych.
Never find them. The triptych. Yeah, that was great.
Remember that?
And then we had the backup thing now, after my experience of getting lost.
Do
the MapQuest. I bring the MapQuest printout with
do
me.
Do you
so.
Really do that?
Yes, after I got lost in the middle of the night. Didn't
you
know
have
I was
a
going.
Backup MapQuest in case your GPS breaks down?
I do.
I mean, that is
well. If
talk
I'm going
about
somewhere
pathetic.
Far, if I'm going somewhere far,
how
away.
Many times have you had to use it?
Never.
Okay. Okay, but now you have to bring it because if you
be
don't bring it, you're going to need it.
Sorry,
okay.
Exactly. Okay, fine. Let's go to George in Marblehead. Hi, George.
Hey, George.
Hi, Jim. Marjorie, how are you?
We're great. Thank you.
Okay, so I get lost all the time. And I'm too dumb to use a smartphone. I can't use it. The kids try to teach me all the time, right? But I can get anywhere eventually, right?
What does that mean, eventually, George?
Eventually, I'll try every street until I get I get lost a lot. But here's the thing. I'm out there with the kids one time. Mom went to Florida, so I got the kids for the weekend. Let's go have some dinner at the mall. So we go. We're looking for Johnny Rockets. So we drive to Liberty Tree Mall. It's not there. We drive to the North Shore Mall. Now, I grew up in the city, so I don't know the North Shore at all. In the city, I can find my way. But I'm driving around. My four-year-old says, "Hey, Dad, maybe we should have had Mom draw you a map before she went to Florida."
Oh, God. Well, did you find it, George, eventually?
Well, here's what happened, right? We drove back and forth between the two malls at least five times, only to realize that Johnny Rockets had closed a couple of years ago.
Oh, my goodness. But, George, you seem happy about the whole thing. Is that...
You know something? I don't mind it. You know, I get to see a lot of things that I'd never see. You know, I get to drive around. And quite frankly, I really can't stand the phones. I have no time for it. I did have a GPS once, and it kept telling me, take a left. And the ocean was on my left everywhere I was going. I'm like, I can't take a left. That's the Atlantic Ocean.
George, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
And here's an email from Carol, who leads tours in Italy, France, and Spain. Mm-hmm. She said, I always use what they refer to as maps, of course. But last year in Italy, they had a GPS, and she could finally exhale while driving, throw out the huge maps, and listen to Gracie. I guess Gracie's on her GPS. But that is the thing. You know what I mean? You're not in a panic all the time.
Well, actually, someone has a different perspective on Italy. Let's take her next. Laura, you're in Andover, and you want to talk about Italy. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Laura.
Hi there. About 8 years ago, my husband and I were in Italy, and we were headed from a small city to the village where his parents are from. And it was a pretty direct route. We had to take a certain highway, and when we went to get on that highway, we weren't able to take it because there was a huge tomato spill in the highway, which, you know, being Italy and all, just made us laugh.
Italy
and it took us on this, what should have been a 40-minute drive, a four-hour drive, and I wouldn't take it back for the world because we met a lot of people. And we left this one tabacchi, you know, like a little convenience store. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, a bunch of Italian men, older men, having their espresso. And we asked them. And every single one of them had a different set of directions for us.
Great.
And when we left the store, they were still arguing over which way we should take.
That's a great story, Laura. That is a great, you know, thanks for the call. You know what Laura's point, the point she makes, which I think you'd agree with, being lost when you're not in a rush to get somewhere is actually a great pleasure. You talked about taking the back roads to wherever you were going,
yeah,
one of the W towns.
That.
If you don't have to get somewhere quickly, you don't have to go to work, you don't have to meet somebody, it is a great thing to see new things, see new streets, see new... Isn't that fun? Isn't that a good thing?
It is a good thing. You know how sometimes when you ask people directions, you feel like they gave you the wrong ones on purpose?
That's never happened. I've done that to other people, but I've... Depends on how they treat me and how respectfully, and then I'll decide. Also, let me just say, you know, you mentioned the whole, I think you said the Hiawatha Brave, the whole man-woman thing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the man can never admit.
Right.
If you ever ask a man for directions, forget him asking for directions, 90% of the men I know, if not 99%, will never admit they don't know how to get you from
right
here to where you want to go.
Exactly.
So they'll often just make stuff up.
Well, that's what's happened to me.
Yeah.
They tell me to go down the corner and take a left, and I go down the corner and take a left, and it's not there.
No, it's not.
I think, did they want to torture
no
me? Or?
No, it's not.
Well, why do you do it to
it's
people,
a genetic
Jim?
Thing, actually. It's if you check the DNA of men, it's a part of their DNA makeup.
Okay, let's go to Mary in Brookline. Hi, Mary.
Hey, Mary.
Hi. I love my husband, but we have fights about this all the time because he's so dependent on his iPhone. But I have to give a shout-out to my mom, Pat, in Weymouth, who, when she taught me how to drive in the late 1970s, early 80s, taught me to pay attention to landmarks. And as I was being taught how to drive, I was also being taught how to look at where I was going. And kids these days, they just want to look at the screen. They have no idea. There's like this world out there. They're passing a McDonald's, or they're passing,
that's a great point,
you know, a museum, or they're passing a bed and bath, and you can make a left or a right there. So, and I have a great Italy story.
We have 30 seconds.
Yeah. Years ago, my husband and I were driving to Pompeii. We got up to a toll booth. It had said Pompeii all along. We were going in the right direction. And literally, as we got up to the toll booth, people were pulling U-turns in the highway because it was the wrong way to Pompeii. And all the Italians who were making the same mistake that we were making, and my husband and I still laugh about this 30 years later. We're literally, like, imagine being on the Mass Pike and everybody realizing they've screwed up the sign and they were turning, making U-turns. And so cars were coming at us the opposite way.
Oh, God.
Oh, we lost you.
Mary, we're sorry. I'm sorry, but that was a great story.
Nothing like having cars come at you the wrong way. There's nothing quite as good as that.
That's always good. That's happened to me in several
occasions. I'm sure it has.
Thank God I'm still here. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Harvard historian Nancy Kane. CNN's John King also joins us to go over the national news. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Our team, producer Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip. Oh, we're out of time.
Whoops.
Amanda and John, I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
See you later.